Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 106, but who's counting? It's Monday, March 22nd. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, folks, well, COVID-19 is still an issue, but I promise you we'll be covering a lot of non-COVID stories later on in the show. First up this week, it looks like we're going to be queuing up another COVID-19 vaccine for emergency use authorization in the next few weeks. That's the AstraZeneca vaccine. And the good news is, in the clinical trials, there were no hospitalizations or deaths in the vaccinated group. 100% effective in preventing the severest disease. So, the moral of the story is, when it becomes available, take it if you can. Okay, well, the race of vaccines against variants continues as cases tick up in many states across the U.S. And this from the Hill. Surging COVID-19 cases in Europe, Brazil, signal warning for U.S. Substantial surges in new coronavirus cases and hospitalizations in Europe and Brazil offer a worrying preview of what the United States faces in the coming weeks and months as the plummeting number of cases here begins to level off. But the precipitous drop that occurred through February is now nearing a plateau, one that could presage yet another spike in cases, just as optimism about the course of the pandemic begins to take hold. Public health experts are nervously watching European nations, where a surge in cases is once again straining healthcare systems. European nations have reported 242 cases per million residents, a rate about 50% higher than the United States, and one that has climbed by about a third since mid-February. The increase appears to be driven by spread among younger people and by the emergence of the B.1.1.7 variant, the so-called UK variant. That study shows substantially more infectious, even among children. That raises the specter that the variant will continue spreading widely, even as older and more vulnerable people receive doses of vaccine. The situation in Brazil is even more frightening. Hospitals in all but two of Brazil's 27 states are north of 80% capacity, and more than 2,000 people are dying on a daily basis from COVID-19. Brazil's 7-day average of new cases stands at 71,800, higher than at any other point during the pandemic. That level of crisis is not likely to return to the United States in the coming weeks, as more than 2 million people every day receive doses of one of the three vaccines approved by the FDA. But some models project more spread in the coming weeks, concentrated in the upper Midwest, the Northeast, and the Mid-Atlantic. Hospital visits are rising in Detroit, Flint, and Macomb County, Michigan. Midwestern cities such as Minneapolis and Chicago are likely to see spikes in the coming weeks, as are the Washington metro area and New York City, according to Policy Lab at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Positivity rates are rising in Phoenix, San Diego, Los Angeles, and Las Vegas, a worrying sign of a potential spike. The race to vaccinate as many Americans as quickly as possible represents the first time in the entire pandemic that the United States has been on the leading edge of the battle against the coronavirus. Americans are being vaccinated at a faster pace than any nation other than Chile, Israel, and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. Americans are being vaccinated twice as fast on a per capita basis than our Canadians, and three times faster than the best performing European nations. The Biden administration has said it will send millions of doses of a vaccine developed by AstraZeneca, one that has not been approved by the FDA yet, to Canada and Mexico. In testimony to the House Foreign Affairs Committee last Thursday, health experts told Congress the United States needs to step up its multilateral efforts to end the pandemic overseas as fast as possible. We live in a deeply interconnected, interdependent world, and an outbreak anywhere can quickly become an outbreak everywhere, said Ashish Jha, Dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. We need a vigorous, multi-pronged, multilateral approach to bring this pandemic to an end by vaccinating a large majority of the world. Dozens of low and middle-income nations have not even received their first dose of vaccine, raising the frightening prospect that unchecked spread could lead to new variants that might evolve a more successful means of evading vaccine effectiveness. If you have billions of people in low-income countries that are getting infected with this, that is where you're going to spit out a variant after variant that could very well change the integrity of our vaccines. These variants are going to just keep spitting out. This is why we're not done yet. And in the U.S., as the race between vaccines and variants continues, one of the things that's benefited the U.S. is actually part of our failure. We have so many people that have been infected that they have some natural immunity, but the next couple articles get at that. It may not be as strong as we hope for. This from Medical Express. COVID reinfection is rare, but seniors more vulnerable. Reinfection with COVID-19 in people who've already had the illness is very rare, and most people are protected against reinfection for at least 6 months, a new report finds. However, immunity appears to drop sharply in those aged 65 and older, researchers found. Reporting in The Lancet, a team of Danish scientists looked at reinfection rates among 4 million people during the second surge of COVID-19 from September through December, and compared this to infection rates during the first surge between March and May. The older age group had only about 47% protection against repeat infection, compared to younger people who seemed to have about 80% protection from reinfection, the team discovered. Less than 1% of those under 65 were reinfected, while 3.6% of people 65 and older suffered a second bout of COVID-19. The finding does not come as a complete surprise, since people's immune systems weaken as they age. Given what is at stake, the results emphasize how important it is that people adhere to measures implemented to keep themselves and others safe, even if they have already had COVID-19, study co-author Dr. Steen Ethelberg of the Staten Serum Institute in Denmark said in a journal news release. In a commentary that accompanied the study, immunologists Dr. Rosemary Boyton and Daniel Altman of Imperial College London called the variation in reinfection rates relatively alarming. Only 80% protection for reinfection general, decreasing to 47% in people aged 65 years and older, are more concerning figures than offered by previous studies, they wrote. These data are all confirmation, if it were needed, that for SARS-CoV-2, the hope of protected immunity through natural infections might not be within our reach, and a global vaccination program with high efficacy vaccines is the enduring solution. Edwards noted that there's a reason why people over 60 have to get extra vaccines to boost their immunity to various infections, because we know that the immune system starts waning in later life. One reassuring thing about the mRNA vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna is that the vaccines do seem to overcome some of the immunity concerns among older people because they produce such robust protection. A limitation of the study is that it looked at infections before there were a lot of the variants in circulation, so it's unclear what impact that could have on future reinfection rates. That's something scientists will have to look at going forward. And I would note, one of the most interesting things about the study, besides being a huge study, is that it's really only looking at about a 5-month difference. So this means immunity is waning in something between like 4 and 8 months. So obviously there's a lot of people that were infected in the first wave that are already a year out from their infection. So as we continue, the longer people had been infected longer ago, the more likely that it's going to wane and leave them open to either reinfection with the wild original virus or to the more infectious and deadly newer variants. Okay, and in a related story, CDC study finds nursing home residents who appear to have recovered from COVID were reinfected with an even worse case. This was actually several weeks ago. So it says a new CDC study found that some elderly people who apparently recovered from the coronavirus later came down with a second, even worse case, indicating that asymptomatic or mild cases may not provide a lot of protection against becoming reinfected with COVID-19. While only two of the five residents experienced slight symptoms during the first outbreak, all five reinfected residents showed signs of illness the second time. The two residents who reported symptoms during the first outbreak experienced more severe symptoms during the second infectious episode, according to the study. One resident was hospitalized and subsequently died. According to the study's researchers, this was noteworthy because it suggests the possibility that people who show mild to no symptoms during their first infection do not produce a sufficiently robust immune response to prevent reinfection. The results suggest the possibility that disease can be more severe during a second infection. The findings of the study highlight the importance of maintaining public health mitigation and protection strategies that reduce transmission risk, even among persons with a history of COVID-19 infection.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, the drive to reopen schools is continuing, and the CDC has updated its guidance. This from The Hill. CDC says 3 feet of distance safe in schools. Federal health officials announce updated guidance on physical distancing in schools, now saying students only need to be 3 feet apart rather than 6. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, students can maintain a distance of 3 feet or more in classroom settings so long as there is universal masking, a change that's aimed at speeding the return to in-person learning. The recommendation is for all K-12 students, regardless of whether community transmission is low, moderate, or substantial, the CDC said. Middle school and high school students should be at least 6 feet apart in communities where transmission is high, the CDC said, if cohorting is not possible. And I would note that about 40% of the U.S. is still in communities where transmission is high. Okay, back to the story. Cohorting is when groups of students are kept together with the same peers and staff throughout the school day to reduce the risk for spread throughout the school. According to the CDC, older students are more likely to be exposed to COVID-19 and spread it than younger children. And I would note that's both behavioral and biological. I think what they're referring to is more behavioral, but the biological point is that older students are actually more able to get the virus and suffer severe disease from it as well. Okay. The CDC also recommends 6 feet of distance in common areas, like lobbies and auditoriums, and during activities like singing, shouting, band, or sport practices. 3 feet is the minimum distance endorsed by the American Academy of Pediatrics and the World Health Organization. For many schools, keeping all students 6 feet apart is not feasible. In some cases, there is no distancing at all. But two of the largest and most powerful teachers' unions indicated they were not likely to support the idea and were concerned about the impact in urban classrooms, which could become much more crowded, especially in buildings with poor ventilation. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten said the union was concerned this change has been driven by a lack of physical space rather than the hard science on aerosol exposure and transmission. While we hope the CDC is right and these new studies convince the community that the most enduring safety standard of this pandemic, the 6-foot rule, can be jettisoned if we all wear masks, we will reserve judgment until we review them, especially as they apply to districts with high community spread and older buildings with ventilation challenges, Weingarten said. Becky Pringle, president of the National Education Association, called on the CDC to provide far more details about its rationale. The CDC's insistence on 6 feet of separation has been a flashpoint of the school reopening debate. The agency has acknowledged that in-person schooling is not a major driver of community spread and that virus transmission is rare in schools compared with the surrounding community. Yet the most recent CDC guidance from last month suggests that schools located in communities with low or moderate virus transmission implement 6 feet of distancing, quote, to the greatest extent possible. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky told members of the House Energy and Commerce Oversight Subcommittee the agency was looking to update its guidance based on this new data. As soon as our guidance came out, it became very clear that 6 feet was among the things that was keeping schools closed, and in that context, science evolves, Walensky said. Remember, folks, while this all may be confusing, there's a lot of moving parts, and the CDC recommendations have to be based on the best scientific knowledge and the specific configuration of circumstances on the ground. So that's why you're talking about how much of the virus is present and, look, you know, like vaccination rights. Obviously, teachers are getting vaccinated. That's helping, even though the CDC doesn't require it. So they're trying to account for all these things when they're making these recommendations. So while things seem to be changing a lot, they're actually just moving along with the conditions on the ground. Okay, well, let's move to the local update and want to provide just a little bit of context for that. As it seems, we've reached an inflection point in the U.S. 27 states have seen their 7-day average of new COVID-19 cases rise by 5% or more. And Michigan cases have doubled in the past 2 weeks. So one question we have to ask is, will we inherit this wave of infections from the north? It must be noted that Michigan has the highest rate of the so-called UK variant present in any state. So, there it goes. Well, Ohio is still hanging in there doing pretty well, though. And Lucas County, right on the border of Michigan there, we're still hanging in there and doing pretty well. Our average daily cases in Lucas County, 7-day average, went down from 79 to 69 in the past week. And we must note that 65 of 88 Ohio counties are still considered high incidence, but three more counties, all rural counties, moved out of the high category in the last week. Unfortunately, the reversal of testing positivity rates continues as the Lucas County testing positivity rate, that is the number of people who get tested that actually end up being positive, moved from 6.5% to 6.6%. So it's edging up. And the state, which has a lower rate and has been declining faster and lower, actually reversed. Now we move from the state of Ohio from 3% to 3.2% in the last week. So it does seem like we're reaching an inflection point that seems to mirror what's happening nationally. Okay, well, active cases in long-term care facilities or nursing homes edged up to 8 from 4, which was the all-time low. And this was one resident with an active case and 7 staff. Also remember that staff are less likely to actually get immunized than the residents are. And of course, they're the outward facing folks to the community, more likely to get infected. So that's a tick up. Again, you know, we might be seeing an inflection point here. Who knows? New hospitalizations have remained fairly steady in Lucas County and Ohio in the last week. The Lucas County death rate over the last 14 days is about the same as the national death rate and lower than the state death rate. There have been 22 deaths in the last 14 days in Lucas County. And I'm hopeful, I think that the death data, that problem that the Ohio Department of Health has had, is sorted out, but we'll still keep an eye on that. Okay, well, good news from the University of Toledo. They only had 5 reported cases, which is by far the lowest they've ever had in the entire school year. Congratulations. And for the first time in their surveillance testing last week, they had 0% positivity. They didn't identify a single positive case from their random testing. And that's been holding at about 0.4%, which was quite low historically for the school year too. So good news, University of Toledo. Cases in the Lucas County schools went down slightly, down to 55 identified infections with 7 staff and 48 students reporting positive COVID tests in the most recent week. Okay, well, moving to vaccines, those that have gotten at least one plus doses in the U.S., it's about 88 million or 25% of the adult population, which is very similar in Ohio and Lucas County. 2.8 million in Ohio for 24% of the population, and Lucas County, 102,000, again, 24% of the population. Well, I've started to track racial ethnic disparities, and Lucas County blacks are only 45% as likely to be vaccinated as whites, and that's the same as it was the week before, so we're not making progress in that. The state of Ohio does a slightly better job with 51, in Ohio, where blacks are 51% as likely to be vaccinated as whites, and that ticked up slightly from 49% the previous week. So we're not doing as well with that measure of vaccine equity. Okay, well, this week the age requirement was reduced to 40 plus for vaccine eligibility, and that'll move down to basically anybody who's got a, who's eligible, which is 16 plus, on March 29th in Ohio. And a nice little thing that you might want to check out is that the TARDA hub to the rec center, in other words, you go to the downtown TARDA hub and you can get a ride to the rec center for your vaccine appointment. And that TARDA ride is free. So, trying to address more barriers to vaccination. Way to go, Lucas County. Well, Ohio as a whole has taken speed over equity as its approach by opening up the spigot of eligibility way faster than we have the vaccine supply to deliver those vaccines. So basically, you know, you're having people in higher risk groups that have not been able to access the vaccine are having to compete with an increasing number of lower risk people. I think the rationale for that is just to get as many people. I don't know. I my own personal opinion is that's not the best approach. But fortunately, the state's vaccine supply is increasing, and this from the Tribune today, a 25% expected increase in the number of COVID-19 vaccines and a sense of urgency led the state to make everyone at least 16 years of age eligible to get inoculated starting March 29th, Governor Mike DeWine said. The state is receiving about 400,000 vaccine doses each week, and that will go up to 500,000 a week starting March 29th. We will soon be receiving more vaccine in the state, which is tremendous, DeWine said. We also want to get as many shots in arms as possible as quickly as possible. As we hear more and more about the variants in the country and in Ohio, we know that the faster we're able to get Ohioans vaccinated, the safer and more protected we will be. But, of course, there's other views to this, and this reported from the Dayton Daily News, a rapid COVID-19 vaccine rollout backfired in some U.S. states. Despite the clamor to speed up the U.S. vaccination drive against COVID-19 and get the country back to normal, the first 3 months of the rollout suggests faster is not necessarily better. A surprising new analysis found that states such as South Carolina and Florida that raced ahead of others to offer the vaccine to ever larger groups of people have vaccinated smaller shares of their population than those that moved more slowly and methodically, such as Hawaii and Connecticut. The explanation, as experts see it, is that the rapid expansion of eligibility caused a surge in demand too big for some states to handle and led to serious disarray. Vaccine supplies proved insufficient or unpredictable, websites crashed, and phone lines became jammed, spreading confusion, frustration, and resignation among many people. The infrastructure just wasn't ready. It kind of backfired, said Dr. Rebecca Wirtz, an infectious disease physician and health data specialist at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. She added, in the rush to satisfy everyone, governors satisfied few and frustrated many. And looking at how effective we've been at one priority population, this from The Hill. Poll, Only half of frontline health workers have been vaccinated. Just over half of all frontline health workers in a new poll said they have received at least their first dose of a coronavirus vaccine, a figure that highlights challenges ahead as the nation drastically scales up its vaccination effort. Health workers were the first groups of people prioritized to getting vaccines when the first doses began being administered. But 3 months in, just 52% of frontline workers said they received a shot, according to a Washington Post Kaiser Family Foundation poll. A large majority of unvaccinated healthcare workers who either have not decided if they will get vaccinated or say they do not plan to get vaccinated express worries about potential side effects as well as the newness of the vaccine. According to the survey, two-thirds of respondents expressed a distrust in the government to ensure the safety and effectiveness of the vaccines. While the top concerns are consistent across key demographic groups, three-fourths of black healthcare workers who have not received a COVID-19 vaccine cited distrust of the government as a major factor in their decision. The survey was conducted from February 11th to March 7th. At the start of the survey, vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna had been authorized. The Johnson & Johnson single-dose vaccine wasn't authorized until February 27th. The poll includes interviews with a nationally representative sample of 1,327 frontline healthcare workers representing hospitals, doctor's offices, outpatient clinics, nursing homes, and assisted care facilities, and those working in home healthcare. The disparity shown among health workers mirrored the national population. According to the survey, only 39% of black health workers and 44% of Hispanic frontline health workers reported personally receiving a COVID-19 vaccine, compared to nearly 60% of white healthcare workers. Part of the reason for such a relatively low vaccination rate could also be a lack of access. Only 34% of home healthcare workers were offered a COVID-19 vaccine from their employer, compared to 8 in 10 of those working in hospitals and majorities working in nursing homes or assisted care facilities, outpatient clinics, and doctor's offices. Well, in all this rush to open up vaccine eligibility, there is one high-risk group that doesn't seem to be open for vaccination. And what do you know? They're actually a captive population. This from Stat News. Prisons are long-term care facilities, so why don't inmates get priority for COVID-19 vaccination? In the four-tier priority list of COVID-19 vaccinations set up by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, residents of long-term care facilities are at the top, along with healthcare personnel, but not if those long-term care facilities are prisons, jails, or other detention centers. The science behind the decision continues to baffle me. Had the COVID-19 pandemic struck 6 years earlier, during the time I spent serving time at York Correctional Institute in Niantic, Connecticut, I would have been one of those inmates fretting about her time in line for the vaccine. During the H1N1 pandemic, I lived in one of the 11% of state prisons that didn't get a supply of H1N1 vaccine in 2009 and 10. I never got the shot and, quite frankly, never knew if I needed it or not. I know that prisoners need this one. Giving inmates the same priority for vaccination as nursing homes and long-term care residents would benefit community health as much as it would benefit the inmates. The Prison Policy Initiative estimated that as of December 2020, as many as 500,000 community infections resulted from mismanagement of the COVID-19 risk in correctional settings. Yet inmates in 19 states will likely be vaccinated only after every free person in the community who's willing to accept it. Incarcerated individuals are one of only two populations. The other is individuals remanded to mental health facilities whose access to care is constitutionally protected. It seems to me that state policies ignore this because they are hopelessly mired in prejudice against people who are perceived to have broken the law, a group that's disproportionately people of color. Swallowing that explanation without interrogating it further doesn't help us. There's another way to look at the differences in vaccine prioritization among states, one that pushes the dialogue forward. It's this. The larger public health infrastructure throughout the country has excluded prisons and jails from definitions of what constitute congregate living settings, from consideration for the dignity inherent in human life, from inspection, from oversight, and for more for so long that including them in nationwide medical endeavor is so foreign that it's practically anathema. Nursing homes and prisons, of course, aren't the same. For one, 174,000 people have died of COVID-19 in nursing homes. That's 52 per 1,000 residents. compared to 2,500 COVID-19 deaths in correctional facilities. That's only one per 1,000 inmates as of March 15th. The difference in death rates shouldn't indicate a relative safety of prisons and jails. Nursing home residents are much older. The average age of a nursing home resident is almost 83 years, whereas the median age for prisoners was 36 years the last time the Bureau of Justice Statistics officially calculated in 2013. If more people in prison were older, more than 388,000 COVID-19 cases in correctional facilities would have ended in death. In other words, this is an important public health point. If you do age-adjusted, is the proper way to compare populations' risk. So clearly, given the kind of institutional constraints or lack thereof, if prison populations had the same age distribution as nursing homes, there actually would have been over twice as many deaths. So they're not being taken care of very well accordingly. And that ain't very good since the nursing homes fared very poorly as well, particularly early in the pandemic. More importantly, nursing homes and prisons differ in how state governments value their respective residents. This distinction isn't just societal, it's structural. Prisons and jails are completely unregulated, unlike nursing homes, which undergo public health licensing. Even correctional kitchens aren't subject to regular oversight because they don't fall under the purview of the Food and Drug Administration. Maggot infestation won't invite an inspection. It's impossible to value the health, wellness, and safety of a population while refusing to oversee the care they receive. Yet that's a contradiction that everyone from lawmakers to corrections professionals to inmates themselves have accepted for years. It's what crept up on state officials when they had to formally state how much they value these lives, even though they do nothing to assure that they're protected, when the Centers for Disease Control called for preliminary vaccination plans. Oversight is especially absent in correctional health care delivery systems. While individual health care providers, physicians, physician assistants, and nurses work under individual licenses, the system that dispenses medical care within a correctional setting isn't regulated. Accreditation, though not licensure, is available through the National Commission on Correctional Health Care, but it's entirely voluntary, and the commission doesn't list the facilities that subject themselves to the process. An exact number of accredited facilities remains elusive. The commission says it accredits nearly 500 prisons, jails, and juvenile facilities. But a presentation given by the commission's managing director, Brent Gibson, in 2014 stated that the same number, quote, participated in accreditation, which isn't the same as being accredited. An expert who asked not to be named told me that the number of accredited facilities is more likely in the single digits. Whether it's 500 or 5, that's still not many of the nearly 7,200 prisons, jails, and detention centers in the U.S. It's important to note that vaccinating incarcerated people against the novel coronavirus at any priority doesn't require an unprecedented level of superintendence. Existing correctional health care providers administer the shots to inmates in routine clinical settings. No outside providers or agencies enter the facility to help with vaccination. In general, vaccination is spotty in correctional settings. Only two states, Michigan and Texas, routinely vaccinate inmates, and then it's for hepatitis B, a bloodborne, not an airborne disease. Influenza vaccination varies among states. Jails are even less reliable in providing these shots because the populations are transient. Providing the same care to inmates as a society at large, even if it's just two shots, is still such a system shock that it's practically inconceivable. It doesn't have to be, though. Federal law currently prevents meaningful oversight or norm-setting forces, such as competition and accountability, from acting inside prisons and jails, and therefore prevents the lives within from mattering. The Social Security Act, which governs the financing of health care for elderly and low-income people, most incarcerated people are indigent, and they have, on average, 41% lower incomes than comparable non-incarcerated populations, contains an explicit exemption for inmates that assures that Medicaid can't cover the medical care they receive. Medicaid coverage for prisoners isn't a silver bullet for vaccine prioritization. Even if the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services were overseeing health care in these settings right now, it wouldn't have been able to order inmate vaccinations. Without a federal law stating otherwise, vaccinations would still have been left to the state's discretion. It's the inclusion of prisons and jails in a larger national medical framework that will serve as the first step in protecting the needs of incarcerated people and understanding how their health statuses affect community members. A more holistic understanding of public health that includes the idea that people in society's shrouded spots are still a part of a shared community, no matter who they are and what they've done, might prevent the competing valuations of life that prevented the best practices for COVID-19 vaccination in prisons in the first place. Okay, folks, well, let's switch gears and do a slew of mostly non-COVID-19 related public health news. This from Science Daily. 13 things primary care clinics can check to help preserve brain health. Primary care clinics can play an important role in preserving patients' brain health, using the American Heart Association's Life Simple 7 as a guide, as well as addressing six other factors associated with cognitive decline, according to American Stroke Association, American Heart Association scientific statement, a primary care agenda for brain health, published in the association's journal Stroke. Preserving brain health in an aging population is a growing concern in the U.S. An estimated 1 in 5 Americans 65 years and older has mild cognitive impairment, and 1 in 7 has dementia. By 2050, the number of Americans with dementia is expected to triple. Primary care is the right home for practice-based efforts to prevent or postpone cognitive decline. Primary care professionals are most likely to identify and monitor risk factors early and throughout the lifespan, said the chair of the scientific statement writing group, Ronald Lazar. Prevention doesn't start in older age. It exists along with the healthcare continuum from pediatrics to adulthood. The evidence in this statement demonstrates that early attention to these factors improves later life outcomes. Life Simple 7 focuses on seven lifestyle targets to achieve ideal cardiovascular health: managing blood pressure, healthy cholesterol levels, reducing blood sugar, increasing physical activity, eating better, losing weight, and not smoking. The new statement suggests primary care physicians also consider assessing risk factors to address cognitive health. The six factors to consider, in addition to the Life Simple 7, that impact optimal brain health are depression, social isolation, excessive alcohol use, sleep disorders, less education, and hearing loss. The statement lists risk factors for cognitive impairment, prevention strategies, and best practices to integrate brain health prevention into primary care. Scientists are learning more about how to prevent cognitive decline before changes to the brain have begun. We have compiled the latest research and found Life Simple 7 plus other factors like sleep, mental health, and education are a more comprehensive lifestyle strategy that optimizes brain health in addition to cardiovascular health. The statement uses cognition to define brain health, referring to the spectrum of intellectual-related activities, such as memory, thinking, reasoning, communication, and problem-solving, that enables people to thrive and navigate the world on an everyday basis. The ability to think, solve problems, remember, perceive, and communicate are crucial to successful living. Their loss can lead to helplessness and dependency. Studies have shown that these domains are impacted by factors that are within our control to change. Prevention and mitigation are important because once people have impaired cognition, the current treatment options are very limited. According to the statement, recent data show that hypertension, diabetes, and smoking in adulthood and middle life increase the odds of cognitive decline in middle age and accelerate cognitive decline in older age. People with dementia experience lower quality of life, and caregivers, typically family members, experience high rates of psychological distress and physical ill health. Dementia is more costly than heart disease or cancer, with worldwide costs estimated at $818 billion in 2015. Primary care is the right place for practice-based efforts to prevent or postpone cognitive decline. This setting can provide comprehensive coordinated care to promote the American Heart Association's Life Simple 7 as a guide for brain health and overall wellness. Professional guidelines also recommend routine screening for depression and counseling patients to focus on healthy eating and exercising a minimum of 150 minutes a week. Implementation of practices to prevent cognitive decline often falls short, referred to as an evidence practice gap. However, new practices and technology like telehealth, which are more common as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic, are helping to address this gap. Lack of access to primary care services may be a barrier to prevention. Even with the Affordable Care Act, an estimated 15% of American adults still lack health insurance, and 25% of Americans do not have a source of primary care. Many people think of high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and other risk factors as affecting only heart health, yet these very same risk factors affect our brain health. Patients might be more likely to pay attention to the importance of addressing modifiable risk factors if they understood the links, Lazar said. I've given lectures, and what people tell me is the one thing they do not want to lose during the course of their lives is their mind. Okay, more medical care news. This from Science Daily. From 1999 to 2017, more than 7.8 billion fall risk increasing drugs were prescribed to older adults in the U.S., and deaths from falls doubled. Nearly every older adult was prescribed a prescription drug that increased their risk of falling in 2017, according to a new University of Buffalo research. The study found that the percentage of adults 65 and older who were prescribed a fall risk increasing drug climbed from to 94% in 2017, a significant leap from 57% in 1999. The research also revealed that the rate of death caused by falls in older adults more than doubled during the same time period. Even minor falls may be dangerous for older adults. Falls that are not fatal can still result in injuries, such as hip fractures and head traumas, that may drastically lower remaining quality of life. Each year, nearly $50 billion is spent on medical costs related to fall injuries among older adults, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The alarming results solidify the importance of interventions to de-prescribe potentially inappropriate drugs among older, frailer patients. Fall risk-increasing drugs include antidepressants, anticonvulsants, antipsychotics, antihypertensives for high blood pressure, opioids, sedative hypnotics, and benzodiazepines, that is, tranquilizers such as Valium and Xanax, as well as other non-prescription medications. Women were also found more likely than men to be prescribed fall risk-increasing drugs, particularly black women, who received the medications at the highest rate compared to women of other races. White women who were 85 and older experienced the largest increase in deaths from falls, rising 160% between 1999 and 2017. Okay, and for better or worse, people know a lot more about public health than they did a year ago. This from Stat News. Driven by the pandemic and the, quote, Fauci effect, applicants flood public health schools. The COVID-19 pandemic has tested the public health and medical workforces like never before, and yet people in those fields say they see emerging signs that the crisis will inspire the next generation of doctors, nurses, and public health professionals to join the ranks. Public health schools, for example, saw a 23% jump in applicants for master's and doctoral programs from fall 2019 to fall 2020, and are reporting an even bigger increase so far in this application cycle, according to the Association of Schools and Programs of Public Health. Well, if you're not ready to do that formal program, you can just listen to this show, which is just for the health of it. We are the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life on WAKT We Act 106.1 FM Toledo. And one foundational truth in public health is that inequalities drive poor outcomes for a population. This from the Public Health Newswire. Study: U.S. infant health inequality on the rise. After decades of improvement, health inequality between infants in the U.S. is widening, according to a recent study. Published in Population Health, the study found that infant health inequality has grown steadily since 2010. The increase happened as income inequality also worsened in the nation, suggesting a possible link between the two factors. In the past decade, the researchers found the health gap between infants born to the most socially advantaged mothers and mothers at the other end of the spectrum steadily increased. The sharpest increase in infant health inequality was found between mothers who did not finish high school and mothers who had graduated from college. And while health risks improved for infants born to married mothers, they worsened for infants born to unmarried mothers. The stakes are high, as poor maternal health can have a lasting effect on children's health. Inequalities that start in early childhood manifest over time and can lead to bigger inequalities, David Rangel, co-author of the study and associate professor of education at Brown University, told The Nation's Health. Kids that start with lower birth weight are likely to have health consequences from it later in life. And in a related story from Science Daily, high blood pressure complications in U.S. pregnancies have nearly doubled. Nearly twice as many pregnancies were complicated by high blood pressure in 2018 than in 2007, and women living in rural areas continue to have higher rates of high blood pressure compared to their urban counterparts, according to a preliminary research presented at the American Heart Association Scientific Session 2020. And in a lesson that infrastructure matters, this from Kaiser Health News, need amid plenty. Richest U.S. counties are overwhelmed by surge in child hunger. While every U.S. county has seen hunger rates rise, the steepest jumps have been in some of the wealthiest counties, where overall affluence obscures the tenuous finances of low-wage workers. Such sudden and unprecedented surges in hunger have overwhelmed many rich communities, which weren't nearly as ready to cope as places that have long dealt with poverty and were already equipped with robust, organized, charitable food networks. Data from the anti-hunger advocacy group Feeding America and the U.S. Census Bureau shows that counties seeing the largest estimated increases in child food insecurity in 2020 compared with 2018 generally have much higher median household incomes than counties with the smallest increases. In Bergen, where the median, New Jersey, where the median household income is $101,000, child hunger is estimated to have risen by 136% compared with 47% nationally. That doesn't mean affluent counties have the greatest portion of hungry kids. An estimated 17% of children in Bergen face hunger compared with a national average of around 25%. So it means that the relative increase is higher in affluent counties than poor counties based on pre-existing infrastructure. That is infrastructure to deal with hunger. Okay, well, and sticking to the food theme, got this book review from Food Politics, the Food Politics blog, Bittman on Food History by Mark Bitton. The book is Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. Bittman has done a thorough synthesis of the key events that transformed our food system from one that was healthy and sustainable, if hard on farmers, to today's unsustainably industrialized system that is mainly set up to feed animals and fuel cars and to encourage us to consume ultra-processed diets. We pay the externalized costs of the system in overweight and chronic diseases that increases our vulnerability to COVID-19 and environmental degradation and climate change. Here is an excerpt. You will hear the food system is broken. But the truth is that it works almost perfectly for big food. It also works well enough for about a third of the world's people, who have the money to demand and have at a moment's notice virtually any food in the world. But it doesn't work well enough to nourish most of humanity, and it doesn't work well enough to husband our resources so that it can endure. Indeed, the system has created a public health crisis, one whose effects have, in turn, exacerbated the deadly effects of COVID-19. And perhaps even more crucially, it's a chief contributor to the foremost threat to our species, the climate crisis. The way we produce food threatens everyone, even the wealthiest and cleverest. And on the solutions side, also from the Food Politics blog, New York City's terrific food initiatives. New York City is taking big steps to improve its food system. Two reports are worth noting, one from the mayor's office and one from the health department. Up first, from the Mayor's Office of Food Policy, they released a Food Forward New York City, a 10-year food policy plan. Here's how they introduce this impressive report. Food Forward New York City is the city's first ever 10-year food policy plan, laying out a comprehensive policy framework to reach a more equitable, sustainable, and healthy food system by 2031. Food Forward New York City emphasizes the importance of equity and choice, enabling a food system where everyone should be able to access the food they want wherever they may want it. To enable this choice, we need to support both our food workers and our food businesses. To strengthen sustainability and resiliency of our food system, we need to rethink our food infrastructure and deepen our connections with the region. Food Forward New York City is organized around 5 overarching goals. All New Yorkers have multiple ways to access healthy, affordable, and culturally appropriate food. 2, New York City's food economy drives economic opportunity and provides good jobs. 3, the supply chains that feed New York City are modern, efficient, and resilient. 4, New York City's food is produced, distributed, and disposed of sustainably. And 5, support the systems and knowledge to implement the 10-year food policy plan. And the second report is from the Bureau of Chronic Disease Prevention at the New York City Health Department. It's updated its National Salt and Sugar Reduction Initiative. In October 2018, the Bureau announced draft sugar reduction targets. Now they've updated them and added targets for salt reduction. As I was informed in an email, the National Salt and Sugar Reduction Initiative is a partnership of over 100 local city and state health departments, associations, and health organizations convened by the New York City Department of Health. we have set voluntary sugar reduction targets for 15 categories of food and beverages. The targets represent a 10% reduction in sugar content of products by 2023 and a 20% reduction by 2026 for food, with a 40% reduction for beverages. The current public health landscape demonstrates that diet remains critical. Even during a public health emergency like COVID-19, diet-related health conditions such as diabetes and heart disease, which can increase the risk of severe illness from COVID-19, are important to address right now. The objective of the initiative is this: to promote gradual, achievable, and meaningful reductions in sugar content in packaged foods and beverages. This is because intake of added sugars is associated with increased risk of excess weight, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, stroke, heart disease, and cavities. The targets are indeed gradual. They hope that they will be met by 2026. The targets are, of course, voluntary. The best this initiative can do is to encourage companies to comply and then hold them accountable. It's a start. Okay, and next up, a few stories on the food, health, and environment nexus. This from Vox. The surprise catch of seafood trawling: massive greenhouse gas emissions. A new study shows that one industrial fishing method emits as much carbon dioxide annually as the aviation industry. Seafood has generally been considered part of a low-carbon diet, but new research points to a surprising link between fishing and carbon emissions. Bottom trawling, a widespread fishing practice, emits as much carbon dioxide as airplanes do annually, a study published in the journal Nature found. Bottom trawling, which entails dragging a weighted net along the ocean floor to catch low-lying seafood such as shrimp, crab, and flounder, is notorious for wreaking havoc on ecosystems. In addition to the species the trawler targets, turtles and other marine life can get caught in the large nets and can die as a result. On top of that, we're learning that trawlers also release significant carbon dioxide emissions into the ocean by disrupting carbon-rich sediments when they rake the seafloor. And meanwhile, on land, a little bit of good news, this from Science Daily. Feeding cattle seaweed reduces their greenhouse gas emissions 82%. Woohoo! A bit of seaweed in cattle food could reduce methane emissions from beef cattle as much as 82%, according to a new finding from researchers at the University of California, Davis. We now have sound evidence that seafood in a cattle diet is effective at reducing greenhouse gases and that efficacy does not diminish over time, said Hermes Cabrieb, professor and chair of the Department of Animal Science and director of the World Food Center. Over the course of 5 months last summer, the researchers added scant amounts of seaweed to the diet of 21 beef cattle and tracked their weight gain and methane emissions. Cattle that consumed doses of about 3 ounces of seaweed gained as much weight as their herd mates while burping out 82% less methane into the atmosphere. Greenhouse gases are a major cause of climate change, and methane is a potent greenhouse gas. Agriculture is responsible for 10% of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S., and half of those come from cows and other ruminant animals that belch methane and other gases throughout the day as they digest forages like grass and hay. All right, we'll go agricultural science. And moving a little more broadly, this from The Guardian. Land could be worth more left to nature than when farmed, study finds. The economic benefits of protecting nature-rich sites such as wetlands and woodlands outweigh the profit which could be made by using the land for resource extraction, according to the largest study yet to look at the value of protecting nature at specific locations. Scientists analyzed 24 sites in 6 continents and found the assets returned of ecosystem services, such as carbon storage and flood prevention, created by conservation work, was, pound for pound, greater than man-made capital created by using the land for activities such as forestry or farming cereals, sugar, tea, or cocoa. The study, which was led by academics at Cambridge University with the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, suggests further modifying nature for human use could be costing society more than it benefits it, but these natural capital costs are often not taken into account by decision makers. It echoes the findings of a landmark review released last month by Professor Sir Partha Dasgupta, the Cambridge economist, which warned that the failure of economics to take into account the depletion of the natural world was putting the planet at, quote, extreme risk. More than 70% of these nature-rich sites were found to be worth more in net economic benefits to people if they were left as natural habitats, and all forested sites were worth more when with the trees left standing, according to the paper. This suggests that even if people were only interested in money and not nature, conserving these habitats still makes financial sense. The authors insisted that their study should not be used to argue for widespread abandonment of human-dominated landscapes, but said it shows there are lessons to learn about the way we treat natural capital. We dismiss the flow of services that aren't easily captured on markets at our own peril. As much as I'd like the world to work in a different way, people make economic decisions on the basis of information like this. Okay, and more cutting-edge science, this from phys.org, that's P-H-Y-S as in physics.org. Study finds evidence of 55 new chemicals in people. Scientists at UC San Francisco have detected 109 chemicals in a study of pregnant women, including 55 chemicals never before reported in people, and 42, quote, mystery chemicals, whose sources and uses are unknown. The chemicals most likely come from consumer products or other industrial sources. They were found in both the blood of pregnant women as well as their newborn children, suggesting they are traveling through the mother's placenta. These chemicals have probably been in people for quite some time, but our technology is now helping us to identify more of them, said Tracy Woodruff, a professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at UC San Francisco. The 109 chemicals researchers found in the blood samples from pregnant women and their newborns are found in many different types of products. For example, 40 are used as plasticizers, 28 in cosmetics, 25 in consumer products, 29 as pharmaceuticals, 23 as pesticides, 3 as flame retardants, and 7 are PFAS compounds, which are used in carpeting, upholstery, and other applications. The research says it's possible there are also other uses for all of these chemicals. It's very concerning that we are unable to identify the uses or sources of so many of these chemicals, Woodruff said. The EPA must do a better job of requiring the chemical industry to standardize its reporting of chemical compounds and uses, and they need to use their authority to ensure that we have adequate information to evaluate potential health harms and remove chemicals from the market that pose a risk. Okay, well, that brings us to the end of our show, and I want to highlight this week's bonus articles, which you can read online at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. 4 articles. First up, Stealth Chemicals, a call to action on a threat to human fertility. In an interview with epidemiologist Shauna Swan, talks about how falling sperm counts and other fertility problems are linked to chemicals and consumer products and explains why the Biden administration needs to follow Europe's lead in restricting these substances. And that is basically because Europe, when they ban things, they ban an entire family of related compounds, where in the U.S., if we get scientific evidence that something's dangerous, manufacturers often produce a chemical that's only slightly different to evade the regulatory authorities, and it has not served us well. Okay, second up for bonus articles. Vaccine acceptance experts weigh in on the AstraZeneca saga. That's about in Europe where they paused the rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine because there were reports of blood clots. And this, of course, is a perfect example of where correlation is not causation. The blood clots were no more common than would be expected just for people, just in normal life with or without vaccination. So basically, they're not caused by vaccines. They happen coincidentally. And in a very different story, a long read but well worth it, the victims of Agent Orange the U.S. has never acknowledged. America has never taken responsibility for spraying the herbicide over Laos during the Vietnam War, but generations of ethnic minorities have endured the consequences. And fourth up, you'll see these advertised on TV, painless glucose monitors push despite little evidence they help most diabetes patients. So if you're interested in reading any of these, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.